Charles Wilkins is one of Canada's most celebrated nonfiction writers. He's written more than a dozen books, including his latest, In the Land of Long Fingernails, A Gravedigger in the Age of Aquarius. In the book, Wilkins reminisces about 1969, when he was a college student and took a summer job as a gravedigger in a large suburban cemetery in Toronto. Wilkins found himself surrounded by several colorful characters.
So there was Scotty, who had come in the 30s from Glasgow and been a gravedigger or sleigh carpenter, as they called the gravediggers in the old days, and had worked his way up to foreman and then cemetery manager and accumulated over the years all these terrible secrets. He had seen every skeleton buried in the cemetery over the years and had all this to protect and was afraid for his life and so on, and was a kind of a fearful but vulnerable kind of tragic old character who I, you know, nobody liked him, but in a sense, I kind of understood something about him. And there was a young guy called Lucio who'd come up from the University of Pennsylvania. He had been studying for a PhD. The Italian guy had been put out of the U.S. at the time because he didn't have his papers in order. And he was a very seditious, sort of funny, nonconformist, irreverent, kind of spit in the eye of everything kind of guy. And I kind of fell under his influence. And that's where, you know, I realized through him that life had other possibilities than this sort of restrictive, conservative upbringing that I had been exposed to. And there was Fred, one-armed, if you can believe it, one-armed gardener, and Rose Gardner, an old Jewish guy who had survived, I won't say escaped, but survived the death camps at Auschwitz or Buchenwald, I can't remember which, and lost his family, and he was there. There was a young woman who was the first female gravedigger ever to appear in the cemetery, and several other teenagers, and just a whole variety, this strange kind of aggregation of... Yeah.
You were really into a different world then, weren't you? I think it's Lucio who's the most interesting in some ways. You talk about him, he's this eccentric guy, but then you also, after a while, admit that he's, what, 6'4" or 6'5" and 240 pounds? He's a big presence.
He was a huge guy. I believe at a certain point he was only tolerated around the cemetery because he was a kind of a security factor. In a place, and I'm not saying all cemeteries are like this, but some of the big corporate cemeteries are places where one might on occasion want a little security. And that summer there was a strike and strike action by the gravediggers and so forth. And at that point, he was a very valuable kind of guy around the cemetery, yeah.
And in fact, we ought to talk about that a little bit, because that's something that nobody even thinks about. One of the most memorable parts of your story is about that midsummer gravedigger strike, midsummer being maybe the pertinent element.
Yeah, it was the gravediggers, which was at that time a part of the Teamsters Union. I'm not sure where they're connected now, but when they went on strike, of course, they had a lot of power behind them because the Teamsters were huge. So no bodies could be buried while the gravediggers were on strike, and they waited, obviously, till the summer was at its hottest point.
So what do you do with the bodies?
Over the course of, I guess it was 2.5 weeks, 56 bodies came into that cemetery, and we had been kind of commandeered for extra work and had put huge industrial air conditioners in the little chapel on the grounds and were storing them there. It became a kind of a cold storage site, and because of various municipal statutes, one of us always had to be in the building with the stiff, so to speak, and it was quite something to be in there when it was 98 degrees out and, you know, 10 below inside. It was literally freezing, and you were in there with a coat on, a parka and a toque and gloves and overshoes and all of that. Eventually the strike ended, and it was also a kind of almost Shakespearean or Old Testament kind of scene when the burial of all those bodies began. I spent the time, a lot of the time I was with these, it was creepy in there. I can't deny it, and spent a lot of my time reading fascinating old documents on the burial industry and all of that. I'm not typically a very morbid guy, but, you know, had to do something, and so became quite an expert and historian on cemeteries and the burial trade.
I suppose reading those things must have had an extra piquancy with 56 bodies in the room with you.
Well, there was a certain degree of piquancy anyway by the time the thing was all settled. I think the other event that really, I mean, apart from the characters and... Go back just a second here, Jim. The other event was that there was an exhumation that summer. There'd been a famous murder case in Toronto, and these guys had to go in and take that body out of the ground, and it was something to see, and I mean, and to experience, and had quite a profound effect on me.
Yeah, that was a very vivid experience, the way you write about it. It's both work and something you probably are glad to have seen once.
That's true, and, you know, all of it struck me as absurd. You know, everything that went on in there, I mean, my whole sense of death at that point, you know, through the fundamentalist background had been this sort of strange theatrical stage set, heaven and hell and the judgment day and the Lamb's Book of Life and the dead would be raised incorruptible and all of that. And it was echoed, in a sense, by all the elaborate sort of burial preparations and the coffins and flowers and framework and music and all of that. But what was coming to me gradually in my transformation, you know, growing into adulthood, was this sense that really reinforced that summer that death was really very plain. Amidst all of this elaborate framework we put around it, here were these lifeless things and we were putting them in the ground. And, you know, that death really in the end, like any other shadow, had no depth or interior or anything and was really only knowable as a kind of a stoppage of the light. And so I was coming to terms with all this as this strike and these exhumations and whatever was going on. And also my sense of the propriety of the culture I lived in was being challenged, because one morning Peter, the chief gravedigger, came into the cemetery and he'd gotten a phone call from one of the neighbors saying that there had been bones on her lawn that looked suspiciously human. I had just arrived. I'd been there perhaps 10 days or something, and he went over and picked them up and brought them back. And later that day in talking to him, I realized, you know, Scotty would phone these people if they found bones and tell them, yeah, they're animal bones and dog bones and the dogs dig them up and this and that and the other thing.
But they weren't.
No, they were in fact human bones. And the cemetery had this practice, this big sort of awful corporate industry had this practice. It basically began with watching burials, and particularly what were thought of as sort of low-level burials, you know, welfare cases or people with no money or whatever. And if a gravesite would be watched, more or less, I mean, not monitored daily or anything, but if no care had taken place over a period of 10 or 12 years, and that's no flowers, no gravestone, they would simply dig the remains up. Like, just, we called it scooping the grave and throw it in what, at that cemetery, we called the quarry or the pit.
And then sell the plot again, right?
And resell the plot, yeah. I mean, the graveyard industry is already a sort of the, probably maximizes the use of real estate to a degree that no other industry ever has. You know, large amounts of money for small amounts of land, right?
Yeah.
So I think things like this and the
so
fact that...
So you've begun to realize that there was a different world than we see from the outside. Everybody drives by a graveyard and doesn't think very much about it.
Yeah, all of that. And I'm not saying that every little country churchyard cemetery is like that or even every corporate cemetery. But I mean, all of this going on became a kind of, plus this, the influence of this guy Lucio, who, you know, posed a sort of seditious, funny, philosophic challenge, literary challenge almost to everything that existed, you know. Nothing was safe around the guy. And so I was developing this sense that life wasn't quite what I perhaps had perceived. Even at university, where values were challenged, this was a sort of a new level of challenge to my perspective on reality.
It wasn't just talk about it, was it? This was
no, well,
a real
I mean,
experience
the
with difference.
First day I got there, I was sent out by Scotty to find Lucio, who was referred to not particularly affectionately as the WAP, and which was, you know, gave me a bit of a sense right away that this is the kind of place it was. So went out and found him, and finally he showed up with three little boxes on his arm, and they were cremation remains, and he was to bury them. And so we went and found the little plots where they were to be put and so on. And he dug the first post hole and said, throw me one of those birdhouses. And I said to him, which one? And he said, any of them. It doesn't matter. They're all the same. And thinking I had misunderstood, stood there kind of gawking, he said, just give me one. So they were put randomly into holes where they would people, you know, and then took me over to a little grove of cedars or crabapple trees or whatever, I can't remember, and pulled out the little bag of marijuana that he carried constantly and was reputed to grow on the grounds. We called it his secret garden. And rolled a little reefer and sparked it and said to me, there are two things you have to remember to survive around here. And one of them is that you must pay absolutely no attention to anybody in any position of authority. And the second thing is this. Don't pay too much attention to reality. Try to avoid it as much as possible. And he said, this helps. And he took a long toke and handed, you know, with the sort of delicacy of the well-practiced tea head, handed it to me. And so began my first morning on the job. And I realized at that point that this was going to be a somewhat unusual place. You know, people sometimes ask me, Jim, did it change your sense of death? And I mean, it did in a sense. They say death became this very simple thing as opposed to this great elaborate sort of theater. But it also changed, I think, my sense of life and gave me a really, really new respect, a very high regard for the tremendous sort of fecundity and also its treachery and its dark side, but its wonderful stories and its humor and all of that. And Lucio, this guy we speak of, this big nonconformist Italian guy, was also a wonderful writer and storyteller. And he said to me one day, Wilkins, when the body goes, you know, I don't know whether there's any soul or not, but I think that rather than becoming a mere soul, the body becomes a story. And that is the survival of the soul, in a sense, that we become stories and we tell stories and are the stories we tell.
Charles Wilkins is the author of In the Land of Long Fingernails, A Gravedigger in the Age of Aquarius.